are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 17th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ellie Mistal, executive editor of Above the Law and legal editor of WNYC's More Perfect, on Donald Trump and the plot to take over the courts. Also on the program today, Donald Trump condemned in the House. Al Green submits impeachment resolution, vote coming soon. Meanwhile, Republican support for Trump rises in the wake of his racist tweets. And I would add racist follow-up in the Rose Garden. New Fed data shows the onslaught of opioids that corporate America unleashed on Americans. Turns out it was Bill Barr who quashed charges in the Eric Garner killing. Federal judge blocks Trump from adding a citizenship question to the census. And half of your fellow registered voters support the ICE raids. Meanwhile, Planned Parenthood parts with its leader within a year in the face of massive political and legal attacks on a woman's sovereignty over her own body. And a new report, Volkswagen's emissions cheating made thousands of kids sick. But the market should just work all that out. Rest in peace. Rest in peace, John Paul Stevens. All this and more on today's program.
But Volkswagen would want to build a car that would work. They would want that car to be good.
Yes, and of course, I'm sure Volkswagen would be punished in the marketplace retroactively.
Exactly, and they're just gonna be they're just gonna do the fraud anyways, even if there is the regulation.
Listen, for folks who do have children at home with asthma, the best way to get rid of this is to sit them down and tell them that Volkswagen's going to pay some fines.
That's right. And then I would write a sternly written Yelp review of the Volkswagen Corporation.
Volkswagen sales are probably going to be off 20% over the course of the next 36 months.
Don't worry,
sweetheart. And now big, deep breath.
They were dominating Honda in the emerging markets in North Asia, but not anymore, sweetheart. Oh, here's your inhaler.
Competition would start kicking in.
Yep. That's really mean, Matt. We will play some clips of Dave Rubin. I know this is going to sound like it's like I'm using it in a colloquial or slang way, but he was schooled by Marianne Williamson, and it was really
quite literally schooled by her. I mean, it was beautiful.
She definitely has a like a first grade school teacher quality. Like, I don't know if she has that
infinite
in general,
patience
or,
for a dim-witted and slightly ill-intentioned pupil.
Michael, that's really mean.
My free speech is going to get suppressed.
Well, that's the thing. That's the dilemma, isn't it?
Yes.
That is the dilemma I have, because I'm a free speech warrior.
Right.
And it's very difficult to, like,
It's kind of a dilemma because you believe in free speech, but also nobody should ever say anything mean about Dave.
What I'm going to say is
interesting idea.
That's on hominem because I like to use big words in an inappropriate fashion as opposed to just saying you're making fun of him like with sophomoric language.
Right.
So I'll say that's ad hominem.
Ad hominem.
And then it makes it sound like I know what I'm talking about because I'm using a Latin phrase. And I'm using it incorrectly. But
can I just say apologies to a Brett Weinstein? But I think you could also say that in her own way, she dunked on him.
Who did?
Marianne Williamson.
On Brett Weinstein?
No, on Dave Rubin. But I know Brett Weinstein doesn't like that word. We played the Joe Rogan
clip.
Oh,
the dunking.
She's like, I don't like that word.
I don't think she was dunking on him. I actually genuinely think she was schooling him.
Yeah, but, no, it was 99% schooling, 1% dunking. But any good schooling involves a little dunking.
I don't know about that, but I guess we could have
probably not.
That's a we could have a debate about that as long as we could just make it about ideas. Here is now I'm sure by now, and maybe we'll play some of this, but we have Nancy Pelosi getting cut off. We don't. Well, Nancy Pelosi was reprimanded in the House yesterday. Because she went ad hominem. No, actually not. She, the House has some old rules that have not been invoked since the, like, I think 1800. I think it was 1801. Where you're not supposed to say anything about the king. That's where it came from. And I think Jefferson sort of extended this to the president, about racial issues. I don't know why you would have that in the 1800s,
I don't
early
know what,
1800s.
I don't know.
It was to preserve a conversation.
I don't That's know what right. Thomas Jefferson was trying to suppress, what sort of factual information he might want to keep under.
Well, it's, look,
don't personally insult me.
Because
I have a slave. Child.
Well,
that, I find that personally offensive.
We need to be able to have a conversation about slavery without getting it all mucked up by race.
New papers, so-called abolitionists, who are using heated and inflammatory rhetoric. Which
that said, she called the president racist on the floor of the House, and after an extended period of time and... At one point, I can't recall who it was that had the gavel, you know, put the gavel down and walked away because everybody was being a little bit uptight about it. But here's the point, that conservatives, when they talk about snowflakes, et cetera, really, you have to understand they are projecting. Now, yes, it's true. Various folks of all stripes tend to get offended at things. It's hard for me to understand that. Virtually impossible for me to get offended by anything that you could call me. But I understand that people who might be more in touch with their emotions and their feelings of self-worth get a little bit uptight. But there's nothing that's more upsetting to a conservative than to be called out for being a racist. There's nothing more upsetting to a conservative than to have their racism recognized as racism. You can call it anything else. He was just being comedic.
Un-PC.
Un-PC. Here is Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends exhibiting that that very same. Now, understand that the federal government, if you want to bring a claim of discrimination in the workplace, they have a detailed code of words that are considered racist, racially bigoted, et cetera, so they can move forward. One of those things in the code is the idea that you would tell someone to go back where they came from.
I'd say that's a pretty unambiguous one.
And coincidentally, that's exactly what Donald Trump said to four women, three of whom who have been born and raised in this country, one of whom is not just a naturalized citizen, but a member of Congress, right? which, to the extent that you can be, I guess, like, American-y, being a member of the government, an elected member of the government, is pretty American-y in, if you get elected in America. If you get elected in a different country, then it's that country-y. Here is Brian Kilmeade getting really offended that other people happen to notice that Donald Trump was a racist.
Oftentimes, there's a voice of reason on the House floor is just flat out fed up. But he should not be fed up with Congressman Collins, because Congressman Collins is going by the manual of parliamentary practice that Thomas Jefferson put into play, which is personally, he's not supposed to use language that is personally offensive to the president. I believe calling the president a racist is personally offensive, but that's just my judgment. The manual also said that members cannot accuse the president of having made bigoted or racist statements. So therefore, precedent set, Collins is 100% right.
First off, I think this is a bad rule to have in Congress.
Insane.
That's you can't
actually authoritarian.
Accuse the president of being bigoted or racist?
Free speech,
baby. That's authoritarian in the proper usage of that word.
It's really stunning.
That's insane.
And let's be honest, it was put there almost, 220 years ago? 200 some odd years ago. I guess last used 120 years ago. Because everyone in that chamber, including the president, maybe not everyone in that chamber, or probably not everyone in the chamber, that's probably why it was so important, had slaves. And they didn't want to be considered, they just didn't want to feel icky about it.
They wanted to have an open exchange. And so what they needed was that the rhetoric was getting too heated. And if you could immediately go to ad hominems.
It's just so offensive to look at someone who has slaves and make it about race.
In 1836 to 1844, it was legally not allowed to discuss slavery in Congress by gag rules passed by Southern congressmen.
Sam Harris at the time. No, I oppose slavery, but we need to have a serious conversation about the discourse.
Right, exactly.
And the other, and Nat Turner led a slave uprising. A lot of people were hurt by this. So in other words, we need to be serious about the unintended consequences.
Here is Eric Swalwell, fresh off of his exit from the presidential campaign, trying to explain to his colleagues why someone might come to the conclusion that Donald Trump is racist.
Minute.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. We have an opportunity today to condemn or condone. Birtherism is racist. Saying a Mexican judge can't be fair because of his heritage is racist. Saying immigrants from Mexico are rapists is racist. Saying there were good people on both sides in Charlottesville is racist. Calling African countries shithole countries is racist. And telling four members of this body to go home is racist.
Do you
think it's not racist?
Gentleman will state his point of order.
Do you think it's not
so
racist?
The gentleman will suspend. Gentleman will state
is that what you're saying right now, Mr. Collins?
Gentleman will suspend.
Mr. Collins, is gentleman it not racist to say these things? Because you can say that right now.
The gentleman from California is out of order. The gentleman from gentleman from California shall suspend.
Basically, Swalwell was challenging Collins to get up in front of that microphone and say these things aren't racist. Now, here's the bottom line with this stuff. They took a poll after the tweets. Yeah, I mean, the margin of error is, you know, bigger because it's done so quickly. But the fact of the matter is that this stuff does not bother Republicans. It simply doesn't. 3 out of 10 independents said they approved of Trump, down from 4 out of 10 a week ago. Democrats, obviously, it dropped. But A national survey conducted on Monday and Tuesday after Trump told lawmakers they should go back and fix the totally broken and crime-infested places where they came from showed his net approval among members of the Republican rose by 5 percentage points compared with a similar poll that ran last week. Now, I I don't know. This is a Reuters poll. It's hard to know how accurate this is. It went down with independents. It went down with Democrats. 41% of the public said they approved of his performance office. 55% disapproved. The fact of the matter is, it makes total sense for his support to go up in the Republican Party. And the reason why it makes total sense is the exact same reason why Donald Trump thinks that it would. Axios writes, it might seem like improvisational madness when Trump tells American citizens in Congress to go back. But those close to Trump say there's a lot of calculation behind his race baiting. Trump knows that in 2016, he won the white vote by 20 plus points. He hopes he can crank out their turnout even higher, especially among older white evangelicals. He knows most of those voters are unlikely to ditch him, no matter how offensive his comments. There was a focus group in Michigan. White swing voters agreed with Trump on immigration. White Democrats, this is an analysis of the 2018 midterms, found that white Democrats with high levels of racial resentment were likely to vote Republican. Do not forget, I mean, I don't know if I've said any single statistic more in the past year. Do not forget, 50% of non-college educated white people thought until the Obama administration that Republicans were to the left of Democrats on race. I certainly, for one, grew up being taught that all that happened in essentially the 80s, following through the 70s into the 80s, following the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 65, that Johnson thought that we were going to lose, the Democrats were going to lose the South for a generation. He was wrong. It was multiple generations. Took a while for people who were traditionally Democrats to realize, oh, wait a second, the Democratic Party is not the Democratic Party of my granddaddy. I'm going to become a Republican now, even though in my granddaddy's time, great-granddaddy's time, they wanted to free the slaves. And it turns out there was still a big chunk of folks like that, not necessarily in the South, probably in areas like the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, who just didn't realize. And when Barack Obama became president and Fox said he's got a slush fund that gives out cell phones to black people, they were like, wait a second. And that's what's going on here. And that's Donald Trump's play. Josh Marshall had an interesting tweet thread about this. Back in 1971, Pat Buchanan, a young aide and speechwriter to Nixon, wrote a memo to the president and his top advisors, which he said, and this is close verbatim, we need to cut the country in half. And I believe we will have the biggest half. Donald Trump is following the same strategy. I don't know if he's ever read any of that stuff, but he instinctively knows it. Less than half the country is racist. I'm talking like motivated to vote in favor of racism. And at that time, Nixon's half was bigger. And this time, it's not, which is why you see things like intense voter suppression. It's why you see things like strategies to mute the vote to suppress the vote, to diminish the vote. He writes, the key in our current political moment, especially in the Senate and to a degree in the Electoral College and the House, the smaller half can hold electoral power. The whole logic of Trumpism is light the Trumpian base on fire and keep it at a boiling point while trying as much as possible to demoralize, exhaust, and gaslight the opposition. Psych everyone out, trigger spoiler third parties, and more. There's really no 12-dimensional chess. Every day is another Trump tally. More racism and rage to keep his diehards boiling. It all comes down to whether the bigger half votes and votes enough to overcome the structural advantages the Trump GOP holds in the Senate, Electoral College, and even the House. The Electoral College creates affirmative action preferences for Trumpers. So Democrats have to overcome those tilted odds, but they can because there are more of them. That's the equation. Frankly, that's why I worry about Joe Biden. Because it's about mobilization. It's not about persuasion this election. There may not be any more persuasion elections going forward. Unless, of course, you can't, neither candidate is mobilizing, right? That's what have been Clinton, Bush, would have been persuasion. No mobilization of either base in a massive way. But we are in an era where mobilization is far more relevant than persuasion. Joe Biden may be able to persuade a couple of wayward Democrats. But the fact of the matter is he will not be able to mobilize the base of the party, where the fish are. Keep using this analogy. He might be out there with a fly rod and picking a couple off in the corners of the pool. But you need to bring in big hauls of fish. So you go where the fish are and you mobilize them. And I just don't think Joe Biden, of all the candidates, has that in him. All right, now, briefly, that the weather is warmer, it might be time to switch up your sheets and duvets to something a little breezier. From Brooklinen's newest linen collection, these beautiful, airy linen pieces that give your bedroom a chic, relaxed feel while providing you with the ultimate comfort. They're available in 12 beautiful patterns and colors. I don't know if I've ever had linen. Have I? I go for the all my
Matt. You would know this.
Yeah, why are you
all my
Matt?
Brooklyn, I know.
Do I have linen, Matt?
Well, do you know?
Of course not. Why would any of us know?
I don't know. It Jesus. Sounds enticing, though. I like the idea of it. I mean, for me, the percale cotton sheets that Brooklinen have are the best sheets I've ever had. And I'm not going to go into the dynamics of my divorce, how we arrange that, but
go
I can
off,
tell you
Ken.
That, well, just 50% of the time I get to choose what sheets I'm sleeping in. So that's always
my sheet time.
Exactly. And it really, I sleep better in my Brooklinen sheets. I feel happier in my Brooklinen sheets. I wake up. I like the patterns. I've got the pinstripes. But I hear about this linen and I'm thinking I got to maybe try these. Brooklinen's newest linen collection is amazing. Like I say, I can't recommend their products more. It doesn't matter who you're giving it to. Graduates, newlyweds, friends, family, treating yourself to the bedroom upgrade you deserve, Michael. And now Brooklinen.com is giving my listeners.
I'm already Brooklinen'd up, man. You kidding me?
It's giving my listeners an exclusive offer. Get 10% off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. I think their pillows must, too. I'm thinking about it. I've been looking at those pillows. The only way to get 10% off and free shipping is to use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY, Brooklinen. These really are the best sheets ever. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ellie Mistal, executive editor of Above the Law. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program executive editor of Above the Law, legal editor of WNYC's More Perfect, contributor at The Nation magazine, Ellie Mistal, on his latest piece, Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. Ellie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I will say that, and what you've done out here is basically outline the broad structures and the statistics of Donald Trump's really, I would say, just I want to say court packing, but it's not actually court packing in the way that we know. But his ability
court
to sort
packing.
Of yes, I mean to fill the courts up with his nominees in a way that is really sort of, I think, unprecedented in terms of numbers. And then you go into detail on seven of the judges that represent this. I will tell you right now, because I think this is the most important thing for people to understand about this era. If you do more pieces on this and you end up doing all 160 or so of judges, we will have you back each time to talk about each one of them. Well, I really do think it's that important. And I don't think that people understand sort of the dimensions of what we're dealing with in terms of the change here. We can elect a president and a Congress and a Senate, and they can propose a wish dream, a wish list of things for folks like me. But the courts can basically say, not going to happen. And yeah. I don't know if folks on the left appreciate that. It's not my favorite part of the American system of governance. But it appears to be we're moving into a new era. Before we talk about that new era and the specific judges, give us those numbers and just put them into context in terms of what Donald Trump has done. And it's not really Donald Trump. It's Mitch McConnell. But what the right has been able to do in terms of reshaping our the complexion, and I mean that both ways, I guess, of the judiciary.
Yeah, so at this point, Donald Trump has, and Mitch McConnell have confirmed, 123 federal judges. And that's as of, you know, when I wrote the piece. I think actually today it might be 127 based on like last week. 123 federal judges or so, including 41 judges to the Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the level right below the Supreme Court. By comparison, by this point in Barack Obama's presidency, he had only confirmed 19. 14 Circuit Court of Appeals judges. So that means that right now 14% of the entire federal judiciary is made up of Trump judges. 22% of the Circuit Court of Appeals is made up of Trump judges. And, of course, 22% of the Supreme Court is made up of Trump judges, as he has two of the nine slots there. He's been able to do this because Mitch McConnell is the Darth Vader of our story here, okay? Everybody remembers, or everybody was kind of alerted to the fact that Mitch McConnell is a problem when he blocked Barack Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. But Merrick Garland, the blocking of that nomination was the capstone on a nearly, you know, years-long effort to stymie Obama appointees. He was stymieing Obama appointees when he was the minority leader, to say nothing of what he was able to basically completely stop the train when he was majority leader. So that when Donald Trump took office, there were 106 federal vacancies open in our judiciary. I don't know if that's a record, because I imagine that George Washington had quite a few judicial vacancies to fill when he became president. But, you know, other than that, it's an unprecedented – there were an unprecedented amount of openings for Donald Trump, which is why he has been able to fill – to appoint judges at an unprecedented rate.
Now, there's a couple points I want to make here. One, when we compare Obama to Trump – in terms of where they are with appointments to the Senate, to the judiciary, people have to remember that Obama, that was the peak of control that Democrats had over the process, right? Up to this point, because they had 2 years of a almost a filibuster proof majority at that time. Maybe it was like an 8 month period of a filibuster majority, maybe a little bit longer in between Franken seating and Scott Brown getting elected. But they had some period of time of that. It's Trump is going to have the majority for the next year or so. So another 25% of his term. And it's very possible that the Senate remains in the hands of the Republicans. The other thing is, we should also note, too, that Barack Obama, my understanding is, did a poor job of getting on the ball quickly, the administration, in terms of lining up those judges. It seemed to take a long time. I know they were obstructionists. There's no doubt about that. But I've heard from other folks that Obama was a little bit slow. They did not emphasize this when they came in.
I agree with that criticism, but I like to retcon that criticism as not just a criticism on Barack Obama and his administration. I think that's actually a criticism on the entire progressive structure, on the entire liberal movement. We, as liberals, have dropped the ball on judicial appointments for far too long. So that when – put it like this. When – Trump comes into office with 106 openings. Remember, we're talking about Donald Trump. He doesn't know the difference between the Supreme Court and traffic court, all right? Like, this is not his idea. What has happened is that McConnell, and especially these outside nonprofit groups like the Federalist Society, which is the big one, but also the Heritage Foundation, also the Judicial Crisis Network, like, there is an entire kind of federal Republican judicial kind of think tank industry that has been grooming, incubating, training, promoting, and putting conservative-minded people in positions to be plucked and put on the federal courts at a moment's notice, right? They have a raft of these people, and that is what liberals do not have. Right, we have not done the work. We have not done the organizational work to have our own raft of 200 potential judicial nominees ready to pounce whenever there is an opening to put somebody on a court. So yes, was the administration a little bit slow on the ball? Did they not particularly emphasize this part of their duties enough? I totally agree with that criticism. But that criticism goes to all of us. You know, that criticism goes to the entire leftist movement.
I agree with that. And we should also say, too, there's one other sort of wrinkle in this is that it appears now that if you want to be placed in the federal judiciary, you need to go and be a member of the Federalist Society. And in the Federalist Society, you will be indoctrinated to this, to the conservative movement legal doctrine, which runs the gamut to what I think are more sort of high profile issues on the left in terms of social social issues, but also stuff like the Chevron doctrine and the role of agencies in the way that they relate to the government, and a whole host of sort of notions about closing the courtroom doors to people and et cetera, et cetera. There is no real analog on the left. To the extent that there is, it's the American Constitution Society. And that appears now, it seems to me, because I think it was like Ted Lieu. There was a couple of people who were brought up in front of the Senate or had to step down from their nominations because of their association with the ACS. And that becomes problematic, because if I'm a young lawyer wanting to get into that sort of like that potential feeder for the federal judiciary, I know that maybe that's not a good sign. I got to keep a lower profile.
I mean, you're talking about Gubin Lieu, Ted Lieu, but yeah, I mean, the Republicans play to win. The Republicans play to win this game. They play it hard, and they play it. They have so far played it correctly, right? So, yes, if you are a liberal person and you work for the ACS, the American Constitutional Society, or even if you work for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, if you work for the ACLU, the conservatives will slam you as being some kind of extreme leftist for your association with those organizations. But the Federalist Society, which is the most extreme right-wing legal group out there, if you're associated with the Federalist Society, well, that's just being a normal Republican, folks. And the Democrats, when they get their chances, when they get their opportunities at confirmation hearings to have the microphone, they don't slam the Federalist Society. They don't bring to light how truly reactionary this group of people are. And it's a huge problem. The other problem with that problem, though, is part of how it goes to the elitism in the legal profession in general. And I think a lot of your listeners can understand that, or were alerted to that during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, where they saw, so many elite legal scholars rally, left or right, rally around Brett Kavanaugh as a good guy and a normal jurist and certainly not a horrible perjurer, right up until Christine Blasey Ford showed up, and then at least the liberals were like, oh, maybe this guy isn't the right one, right? So one of the reasons why the Federalist Society kind of goes under the radar is because they get people while they're young. The Federalist Society is all over law schools, right? They find people with right leanings in law school, and they start indoctrinating, training them, literally giving, I went to Harvard Law School. They have the best food of any group, having an event. And so they get them there, and they make it so that it's all part of one kind of elitist community that even liberals have a hard time, apparently, some of them, speaking out against when they get their opportunities.
All right, let's go through. We know from a numbers perspective, like what the damage is here, and I think hopefully through we'll talk a couple of these judges to get a sense of what the sort of the legal implications are of these folks on these courts. They all are uniquely horrible in their own ways, so it's hard to sort of pick one. But let's just start with Don Willett. First off, he is on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Just explain for folks the circuit court system and the relative importance of the various circuit courts.
Right. So there are 12 circuit courts. They each oversee the law in a different region of the country. Right. So if you've heard about the Ninth Circuit, which I'm sure you have because of the Muslim ban and all this kind of stuff, like that oversees California, Oregon, and Washington. Right. The Second Circuit, where I live, oversees New York. The Fifth Circuit is the Texas, Louisiana. Those are those people. A big reason why the law is different depending on what state you are in is not just because of your state courts. Your state courts are handling, you know, your criminal justice issues, you know, manslaughter and arson and that kind of stuff, and some kind of civil law. But the circuit courts oversee federal law as it is applied into these different regions. The circuit courts are why it is harder to have access to an abortion in Texas than it is in New York. It's not because of a Texas court versus a New York court. It's because of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals versus the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. These courts of appeals are the rung right below the Supreme Court, and just to, from a statistical standpoint, just to emphasize how important they are, the Supreme Court last year, the one that we all care about, or at least we know we're supposed to care about, they heard 70 cases last year out of 7,000 cases that were appealed for Supreme Court review and denied, and that doesn't even get into the thousands of cases that were never even appealed to the Supreme Court. So for a lot of the law that you experience in your kind of day-to-day life, that law, the final arbiter on that law is often the circuit courts of appeals.
And these circuit courts take on distinct characteristics in part because, and this is less relevant in the age of McConnell, but it used to be the home senators from these states, right, which make up any given circuit, would recommend the judges and could prevent and block judges by withholding what was known as a blue slip. McConnell has done away with that. Patrick Leahy is sitting there probably pining to reinstitute it in the event that he takes over the Senate, because that's just the way that Democrats roll. They completely forsake any sense of power. But be that as it may, is that why the characteristics? And then also there is the nature of the cases that come up in those circuits is a function of sort of the people from there. I mean, why is it so reliable that the Fifth Circuit will give us, you know, the cases that would harm a woman's right to choose, for instance, as opposed to the Second Circuit?
Right. So you're right on both points, Sam. And you're absolutely right that Patrick Leahy and Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Schumer are somewhere being like, oh, I missed the blue slips. Where did they go? Like the way that it used to work was that if the senators from the region of the circuit that you were nominated from had what was called a blue slip, which was like a quiet way of telling the president, yeah, I don't like that guy. So if you want to say like, hey, Elie Massal should be a judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, Kristen Gillibrand could just slip a little blue slip and be like, no, we're not going with that crazy guy. And then I wouldn't be nominated, right? Like, that's how it was supposed to work. McConnell said, to heck with all that. He's nominating the Federal Society of judges that he wants, and he has the power. You can't stop him, right? So they've completely done away with the blue slips, which is one of the reasons why some of these particularly radical conservatives are on the court now, and they weren't on before, as I kind of explained in my piece. But the other reason why you get these very kind of distinct legal traditions in each circuit is that each circuit itself is, you know, supposed to be respectful of its own circuit precedent as well as Supreme Court precedent and whatever. So, like, the law kind of builds up over time in these places. And then the third thing is, as you say, you know, the reason why a woman's right to choose is being kind of attacked in the Fifth Circuit and not in the Ninth Circuit is because Louisiana is trying to pass laws ending abortion, whereas California is not, right?
Right.
So if you have a law on the book saying nobody can have an abortion in Louisiana, that's going to end up in front of the Fifth Circuit. You know, California isn't passing that kind of stuff, and so they don't have to rule on that kind of law. They don't have to make precedent on that kind of law, and the system just kind of reinforces itself.
So Don Willett on the Fifth this Circuit guy. Of Appeal. Yes, tell us about Don Willett.
So, I first of all, Sam, look, the hardest part about writing this piece was picking just seven.
Right.
Because
well, like I say, if you write a follow-up, we'll have you back.
Right. I highlighted Don Willett because he is famous in legal circles because he used to have a Twitter account. And you know, it's very, very rare for a judge to have any social media exposure, much less as well regarded as Willits was. And his Twitter account is, you know, fine. It's like dad jokes and here's some cornbread shaped like Texas and all this kind of, you know, ha aw shucks humor laced in there with some seriously anti-LGBT, anti-trans rhetoric, right? And that's his thing. I like to say that people generally in real life are nicer than they are on Twitter, but Willits is the opposite. He goes to Twitter to look nice, but then when he gets to work, that's where all of these kind of mean streaks come out of him. His issue, he's very anti-marriage rights, to the point that when he was now on the state court, not on the circuit court in Texas, even after the same-sex marriage case went through, he did everything he could to delay the implementation of same-sex marriage in Texas. He's basically the Kristen Davis woman from Kentucky, only in a robe, as opposed to a mere clerk, right, on LGBT rights. He's against women's rights. He's a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. That's another thing that I try to tell especially young people about why they should care about the courts. Young people think that, like, the reason why we don't have reasonable gun regulations is because the NRA is so powerful and elected officials are afraid of the NRA. That's partially the reason, but the other reason is that if you try to pass significant gun legislation, courts will knock those laws down, because they have people like Don Willett on them who believe that the Second Amendment is, like, pretty much the only individual right that matters.
So, all right, and we should say James Dobson of Focus on the Family, he doesn't seem to be in the news as much these days, once called him the most conservative judge in the country, which is, I don't know, it's like...
And Don Willett's proud of that.
Yeah.
He put that in his campaign ads. Hey, I'm the most conservative judge in Texas. Like, who says that?
Well... I mean, I guess it's Texas, and it seemed to have worked. Tell us also about Willett and maybe this is good to set this, because, you know, certainly a lot of these judges would be interested. Like, what can a judge like this do to implicate marriage equality? Right, it's the law of the land. We have already, you know, Obergefell versus Hodges. It exists, and the Supreme Court has ruled on this. What can be done by circuit judges to begin to unravel this? This is, of course, premised on the idea that someone brings these cases in there that are already calculated to give the judge an opening to do these things. But what can they do? Like, what can they do? Like, what, you know, isn't it resolved now?
No, and here's the thing, right? If you think about marriage equality this way, all the Supreme Court has said is that if you go to your justice of the peace and ask for a marriage license to marry a person of your same sex, you cannot be denied. That's all it is, and that's great. That's amazing. That's serious progress. But that's also pretty limited, right? There are all these other kind of attenuated benefits of marriage that conservatives can still try to stop. For instance, same-sex benefits is something that Don Willett has been very against throughout his entire career, refusing to give, you know, death benefits to people who are married in a same-sex couple. We think that we're going to get some – we think that's probably also now settled. But there are other issues, right? Let's say, okay, if my wife and I are married, and if we wanted to adopt a child, we could. But if my wife was named Chris as opposed to Christine – and I want to go adopt a child, well, then guess what? Don Willett has actually written opinions about this, would say that gay people are not allowed to adopt children, right? Even if they're in a married, committed relationship, right? So there are all of these, and that doesn't even get into the fact that, like, okay, the Supreme Court says that I can be married, I can have a same-sex marriage. Can I get a cake at my wedding? Can I get a floral arrangement up in here? Probably not, according to these conservative judges. So while, yes, the basic right to get a marriage license is now relatively secured, we think, there are a lot of benefits to being married that these conservatives can still try to deny the LGBTQ community.
Okay, let's talk about Collins v. Mnuchin, because Willett was involved in this. What's the relevance of that case?
Okay, so... as I'm sure many people have heard, Donald Trump gets pissed off at his director of the Federal Reserve Board from time to time, right? He wants interest rates to be low because he thinks that helps the economy. The Fed is supposed to be a nonpartisan, nonpolitical entity, and it's supposed to, like, monitor our money and make sure that inflation doesn't get too high and all these other things. And if this, and Donald Trump wants to put political pressure on the head of the Fed to do what Donald Trump wants. Technically, Donald Trump should not be able to fire the head of the Fed. That's the whole point of having an independent agency. But in Collins versus Mnuchin, Willett was part of a decision that explained a very minor agency, a Fair Housing Administrative Head. And basically, Trump had fired him, and there was a lawsuit. And the Willett court said that it was okay for Trump to fire this very minor agency head. But the way they explained the agency made that agency sound suspiciously like the Federal Reserve Board. So what they're doing, and you were just talking about why are different circuits different? Like, what Willett was doing there is setting precedent so that if Trump fires the head of the Federal Reserve, the Fifth Circuit can then just point to this decision that they themselves wrote and say, like, oh, we're not being crazy. We're just following our own guidelines about who Trump can fire and who he can't fire. And this is totally in keeping with precedent that we just made up last week. That's the problem with a case like Collins v. Mnuchin. It's again, the conservatives are not dumb, right? They know what they're doing, and they're basically like setting up a paper trail right, so that they can justify overturning well-established law in the future.
This is a dynamic that I think people really have to understand, because there's a strong argument that we're seeing this on the Supreme Court in a whole host of areas, not the least of which the the questions of what rights or what ability, I guess, agencies have to actually take a broad mandate from Congress and put it into effect so that the EPA can decide that, hey, this new material that's developed that's being burned and put into the air is actually a pollutant. We're going to go after that. We don't need Congress to do the research on this and then tell us specifically go after this one particular pollutant. Go ahead.
Again, when I talk to young people about climate change, if you care about climate change, your problem is not which Democratic candidate supports the Green New Deal and which one doesn't. Your problem is that conservatives have been stacking the courts with these deregulatory judges, and when they say deregulatory, you think that they're just talking about laissez-faire capitalism? No, they're talking about removing the ability to force corporations to do things that we need them to do for environmental purposes, right? That's the whole point of this deregulation gambit by the conservatives. And so if you don't control the courts, then guess what? You can't get a Green New Deal because you can't get the regulation necessary to control carbon emissions or mercury leaking or methane tanks. Like, you can't get those regulations in place if you have all these judges who say that regulation is basically unconstitutional.
Right. I mean, to me, this is like the area where it's really the most dangerous. Because at one point, social mores will catch up and they'll overwhelm the judiciary. But I just don't think there's enough sophistication, frankly, amongst the general public that understands that these are courts that are going after the structure of our government. They are inhibiting, never mind specific regulations, like you say, they're inhibiting the mechanism in which to create these regulations, and that's what's so disturbing. Let's go to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, Chad Riedler. And I got to say, maybe this is an important time to say this too. Everyone you've picked out here, but for one, is someone, well, maybe one is 53, but the rest are in their late 40s. I mean, this is all folks sort of like vaguely in who came up of age in their teens and in their college years during the Reagan era. And it seems to me that's not a mistake. I mean, like, you're getting the youngest people possible and put them into lifetime positions, and they're going to be, I mean, these are people who, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of some young conservative who's going to have the opportunity to appoint to the Supreme Court when they're president, 20 years out from now.
Yep. And again, like I say, these people have been bred. They weren't born this way. They were bred this way. They were incubated this way. They were taught to be this way, and now they are being unleashed on the rest of us. So when you talk about Chad Riebler, 47, I believe, I highlighted him to do two things. One, everybody wants to fight about immigration right now. Everybody wants to fight. Everybody's, oh, these children in cages. Oh, no, what are we going to do? Chad Riebler is the guy that wants to put them in the cages. And now, instead of being a mere political advocate, he is a judge, which he will have the power to say, no, we actually don't have to treat children humanely if they come here from another country. We actually don't have to give them toothpaste. We actually don't have to give them showers. Not by, you know, constitutionally speaking, they have no rights. That's what Chad Riebler is able to do now in his position on the circuit court. The other reason why I brought him up is that he is a punishment for Democrats who did not take back the Senate in 2018. Yes, midterm, blue wave, we won the House. Ooh, great, I love it. Awesome. We didn't take back the Senate. In fact, we lost seats in the Senate. Chad Riebler was nominated by Trump before the midterms, when the Republicans only had a one-vote majority in the Senate. He was denied appointment because he also happens to be against the ACA and has written all these kinds of briefs of trying to roll back pre-existing conditions and all this kind of stuff. So he didn't have Susan Collins' vote. Susan Collins will vote for an alleged attempted rapist, but she won't vote for somebody who openly is against Obamacare, right? So she didn't have Susan Collins' vote, so he couldn't get through before the midterms. But after the midterms, when Republicans picked up seats in the Senate despite the blue wave, Trump just renominated him. Trump and McConnell just like, let's roll it back. And this time he passed, 52 votes, because they still lost Collins, right? Chad Riebler is what happens when Democrats do not focus on the Senate and instead have their eyes starrily fixated on the presidential nomination, right? I put him in there specifically to say that all of these kind of interchangeable centrist white Democrats who think that the only thing they can do with their lives is run for president, man, go back home to your state, to your purple states, and help us take back the Senate, because if you don't take back the Senate, you cannot either get your own judges, as Barack Obama proved, or you cannot stop Trump judges, as Mitch McConnell has proved.
There's two more things to note here. Well, one is just building on that point. A crappy senator in Texas, say, or in Alabama, for that matter, means a great deal in this context because, like you say, one vote. One member of the Republicans abandons this guy and he doesn't get in. I don't care if Doug Jones, you know, is up there voting on crappy stuff half the time. If he's keeping out judges like this, that's a good thing. For the far left, who might want programs that that are more humane and whatnot. He was Attorney General Jeff Sessions' right-hand man in the Civil Division of Department of Justice. So whenever they were asking, is it okay to separate children from their families, he was the one saying, yep.
And he didn't have to do that. There are other people this is not a case of just following orders, right? There were other people in the Department of Justice who refused to make these arguments. There are other people who have resigned. There are other people who have quit. Chad Riebler volunteered for the assignment. Right. So you make the point about, you know, the Doug Jones and Joe Manchins. I mean, I've sat here online the past week and a half, and I've had to hear liberals throw Amy McGrath under the bus, who's running against Mitch McConnell. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? If Amy McGrath can beat Mitch McConnell, that would be the most important senatorial victory that we have had since Stephen Douglas lost his seat to Abraham Lincoln. All right, actually, Douglas won that election. So I don't even know where I would go, right? John C. Calhoun or something. Like, taking out a Mitch McConnell is so important. And if it takes a conservative Democrat to do it in Kentucky, fine. We can live with that. Right. I want to hear – if liberals want to get on liberals who are not progressive enough – Go to California and deal with Dianne Feinstein, who's the minority leader on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who does nothing when these conservative justices show up. If liberals want to get on other liberals for not being progressive enough, go to New York, where Chuck Schumer is the minority leader for the Democratic Party and does nothing when these judges come up.
I want to endorse everything you just said. If Amy McGrath voted with the Democrats 5% of the time, it would be still the greatest victory we could hope for in getting rid of Mitch McConnell. I mean, in terms of actually like material benefits to
society.
Folks on the society, everybody. All right, let's do one more. I want to do Amy Barrett because the next. We don't know who the next justice to leave the Supreme Court is going to be. If it's going to be someone on the right, it'll probably be Clarence Thomas. Although, you know, I've talked to people who think he's not going to retire. I mean, if I was him, I would. But there are some people who feel like he likes being on the court, believe it or not.
I think they're carrying Clarence Thomas out in a body bag. I don't think he's going anywhere.
That's what I've heard. And then you got to look to essentially assuming, you know, that there is no God and there's no intervention on the next justice to leave the court will probably be someone like Ginsburg or Breyer. And Amy Barrett is the type of pick that, you know, would sort of make it look like and we should say. There was a piece just the other day about, where do I have that? About Jimmy Carter and how he diversified the courts significantly, and that diversification is getting rolled back relentlessly, it seems, by Donald Trump. But the idea of like picking, there's a couple of women out there where presumably, like, well, she's a woman, yet it turns out she's like, I think you're right, the handmaid.
Yeah. So the piece we're talking about, by the way, is Mark Joseph Stern on Slate. It's a really good piece about Jimmy Carter and all he tried to do. So your listeners should go check it out. Amy Coney Barrett is what comes next for the Republicans, right? You are not projecting. I am not projecting. We are not playing identity politics with this. The Republicans have said explicitly in places like the National Review, Donald Trump has said it to his staff. That's been reported by Axios. They have said explicitly that they are saving Amy Coney Barrett for when Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies, because when they overturn Roe v. Wade, which is what Amy Coney Barrett is designed to do, they want a woman to do it. Right. I don't know why. I don't know why that side seems to think that if they smash women's rights with a woman, people will be somehow confused as to the horrible sexism of the decision. But that's what they think. This is kind of like you referenced Clarence Thomas earlier, right? This is kind of their thing where, like, they think that if they can bring one of the members of the oppressed group on to help with the oppression, it kind of makes the oppression better somehow. I don't know why they think that, but that is how they think. And they have explicitly said that they want Amy Coney Barrett to be the one writing the majority opinion when they overturn Roe v. Wade. She's being primed and pumped for this position. And it's not just, and by the way, she's not just against Roe v. Wade, right? Like, she's got issues with birth control. She's got issues with women's rights kind of up and down the ledger here. She's a huge religious conservative. She's written extensively about her views about Catholicism and the law. She's the problem, and she is absolutely what happens if, God forbid, RBG dies before Trump is out of office, whether that's in the next year or in the next 6 years. She's what we get next.
And you write that she's hostile to reproductive rights. And then the other one is judicial precedent, because that's going to be the way that they do this, right? Is they're going to have to construct and they've already begun to construct this, it seems, in their dicta on a whole host of different rulings on the Supreme Court, how you can justify overturning precedent.
Right. So I try not to get too much into the weeds about precedent, because it is a little bit of a legal mumbo jumbo word. But basically, for most of people's lives, the Republicans have argued that they do not want political judges. They want restrained judges who respect the precedent of previous Supreme Courts, right? That's what they've said they've wanted, right? It's under the Federalist Society and under McConnell and under kind of the current our current situation that Republicans have thrown that piece of hypocrisy straight out the window. They're no longer even pretending anymore that their legal goals are anything other than a complete kind of supremacy of the Republican agenda. And if there is Supreme Court precedent that stands in the way of the Republican agenda, they are more than willing to overturn it. They'll have to get do some legal fancy footwork to try to say we're not really overturning it, we're just updating it. They'll do some legal they'll drown it in legalese so it's not as raw as it really is. But their whole point is to directly overturn previous precedent set by the Supreme Court. And Amy Coney Barrett's entire kind of scholarship is based around her arguments for when it's okay to overturn precedent simply because you disagree with it.
I mean, I think that's a good place to sort of leave it. And I should just encourage people. There's four more judges to look at. And just the whole piece is hugely important, I think, for everyone on the left to understand the relevance of the Supreme Court. This was a big deal in the run up to the 2016 election. And a lot of us around here felt like that was not fully appreciated on the left and the importance of all the flaws that were represented in Hillary Clinton's politics for many people on the left. This issue was a paramount. And I think in many respects, that open seat is what led to Donald Trump as much as just about any other thing. Ali Mistal, the piece is Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. People can find it. The Nation magazine will link to it on our front page at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. We should just touch on this briefly. I don't want to make too much of a big deal about this, but it's important for people to understand. Do we have a little bit of a clip from Pacman's thing? That's all we do now is we just watch Pacman's show and then we just do everything that he's doing. So I don't spend a lot of time looking at our statistics on YouTube because I'm busy and I don't know what to do with the statistics. And then I feel like I need these statistics. I should know them. They should mean something to me. And I look at them and I'm like, it's interesting to see the little bumps on the graph, but I don't really know what that means. But again, I think we mentioned this yesterday in the context of the Gavin McGinnis scandal, McGinnis Gate, where he allegedly called into David Pacman pretending to be just a random caller to convince Pacman to go on his new TV show. And because I had also been offered $5,000 to go on this show, on his show, I was interested in this. Again, I want to reiterate, if you didn't catch that piece yesterday because it was in the fun half, that I am open to going on Gavin McGinnis's show, but it would have to be for $250,000. And that is my pre-negotiated rock bottom price. I want to be, that's the best I can do.
I would do $50,000.
There, okay.
Just putting it out there.
And
I would negotiate probably rock bottom 35.
I'll just take the five.
I started at $1 million with myself, but I worked my way down to 250 because I really would do it for 250. But aside from that,
250, 35.
Well, the thing is,
Jamie texted.
If I had 250, I would pocket like $1.50 of that.
Right.
That's what we call it when you get in that kind of.
I know, I get it.
I pocket $1.50 of that, and then I'd spend $100,000 to try and bury him on the SEO of his show, like to make up for it. But
sure.
All right, be that as it may. So Pacman got in touch with me the other day and he said, have you noticed over the past 5 months, I guess it was starting in March, that your suggested videos, the percentage of videos that are getting hits from suggested videos has gone down? And It took me a while to understand what he was talking about because, like I say, I'm not terribly adept at this stuff. But I went back and I looked, and it has been the case that the percentage of people who are finding our videos who are sort of like leaning into finding us has gone up relative to suggested videos, which are a function of the topic. And here, play this clip from Pacman where he explains what this is about.
Instead, CNN's YouTube channel, Fox News' YouTube channel, MSNBC's, and other legacy corporate media channels. Now, I don't want to redo the whole story because there's so much new data that I have for you today. And again, I could get destroyed by YouTube for doing this. But I have to tell you because what's going on and what we've uncovered is absolutely stunning. Just to refresh a little bit, our channel has been getting fewer and fewer views from YouTube's recommended video algorithm. When you watch videos on YouTube, YouTube suggests other things to watch alongside or below the video. The idea is to keep you watching as long as possible. Okay. We used to get a lot of recommended video views from YouTube's algorithm. I told you previously, I estimated that we had lost about 2 million views per month from this algorithm, recommending our videos more and more infrequently. That was a massive underestimate. There's a disturbing new metric I looked at on YouTube. Some of the people watching our videos, like anybody else's, some of the people are subscribers and some aren't, okay? Of course, you don't have to be a subscriber to a YouTube channel to watch the videos on that channel. We have lost millions of non-subscriber views per month over the last several months, and non-subscriber views are determined by YouTube's algorithm, okay? This graphic we're putting up on the screen is disgusting.
Okay,
the numbers of views.
All right. So basically, Pacman goes on to say that he has gotten information that his show, my show, in fact, not even, and I think Kyle Kalinske's, but not just shows on the left, all top independent news shows, and I don't know how that's defined, over 500,000 subscribers or what, I don't know, have basically been pushed to the back of the line in the algorithm for the sake of pushing the cable television news shows to the front of the line when they cover issues. And this dynamic between subscribers and non-subscribers is the same that we've had. Now, I will say this. Because of the growth that we've had over the past year and a half, in January of 2018, we had 180,000 subscribers on YouTube. We now have, I think, 600,000.
We're at 599 right now.
Oh, is that right? So I think we're almost at 600,000. We've had enormous growth on the show on YouTube. We have not seen dramatic downturn in our views because we've been growing in other ways. But, and frankly, I'm still working on the numbers to get them specific. But had they not changed that algorithm, our growth would be enormous now. And look, obviously, YouTube has its own business strategy. And if they want to emphasize clips from CNN put out by CNN or MSNBC or ABC or NBC or whatever it is, it's their right to do so. It's another reason in my mind why you want to break up the monopoly that Google has with YouTube and feeding this vertical integration they have with advertising and search going into the videos. Because if you had competitors and you did not have the competitive advantage they have, and it's beyond a competitive advantage, to own all the advertising that supports this and to own the search functioning that supports this, there would be a lot more opportunity for people to find what they want. You can't go in to YouTube and say, I want to know about this story from an independent source, from a source that is not, and, you know, we've talked about this. I think we talked about it quite a bit at Netroots. These cable news outlets, they filter out folks who are going to give a different perspective on things. And so they don't have to issue edicts more often than not to their hosts and whatnot, because everybody's of the same mind. And it doesn't occur to them to question some of the mainstream analyses. I got a story here from Politico about why Democrats' oversight machine is moving so slowly against Trump. And it says that they're having trouble staffing up. Now, I think there's some validity to it. But the bottom line is, if you dig a little bit deeper and talk to the right people, you can find out that, like, no, they could have staffed up earlier. Or they could take their resources and they could hire outside firms. And these Politico reporters, who I think are pretty decent reporters as far as they go, didn't ask the right people. Now, this story's never going to even make it to CNN or MSNBC, or certainly not Fox or whomever. But it's stories that we cover. But if you Google oversight, or you search on YouTube for oversight or whatever it is, you won't get to us as quickly. You got to be looking for us and then hear what we have to say. And so basically what YouTube has done is they have made it harder for us to break out of a ghetto that is defined by who we are rather than what we're talking about. So people can't find us when they're interested in a specific issue in the same way. They have to be interested in sort of us, and then they find out about these issues. Like I say, from a business standpoint, it hasn't. The only effect that it's had on us is that we're not growing in the same way that we would have. But the reason why we're on YouTube is to get access and to provide different information to people. To be honest with you, I don't know what you can do about it. Other than if you have an opportunity to go and like our YouTube stuff and subscribe to it and upvote stuff, that may help down the road. I don't know if, you know, YouTube is going to care about what, you know, a small group of people say in terms of the way they should go about this stuff. But any way you can support the show obviously helps. But I don't know if there's a direct way to do this. But I want to let you know this dynamic's out there, because people have emailed me because they've seen, you know, Pacman's thing. And I'm getting contacted by some reporters who want to know some information about it. So I just figured I'd put it out to you.
We get in a lot of trouble for doing this.
Probably not.
We're taking a huge risk. I would just like to say that I think YouTube's been extremely fair and helpful on the TMBS channel. I have criticisms of Google as a company and YouTube, but whew, we're taking a huge risk here.
I can't wait for 8 years from now, where like all of those things that are almost jokes become
reality,
not jokes at
all.
Yeah,
just sort of like, well, those things. Well, yeah, no, it would be.
It's like watching, like with you, it's like watching like a Al Pacino movie or like a Robert De Niro, where
right. At
one point, like they're just playing.
Yeah.
Themselves 10 years.
Exactly. Hoo-ha.
All right. We're going to take a quick break.
I think the TPP is actually really important for the future of the Pacific.
We've been trying
and
to do
now
the Pacific.
We're doing a deep dive with the head of the Carnegie Council and the head of Asia Strategy for Dow Chemical.
And remember, Dow brings good things to life.
And remember, Dow brings good things to life. This is the Michael Brooks Show.
How do we make ourselves look like a giant corporation to Google?
Well, I mean,
that's
think the
actually
is,
a really good idea.
I think the point is that they
we
probably
should all have like fake like mustaches and stuff. Like, hold on, Google. Let me cut you in half.
This
is the head of our marketing department.
Let's just run like BMW advertisements that they're not even paying us to run.
That
just
would be
as
great.
If we have.
And today's show is brought to you by Mercedes.
I think they're struggling around to find out what their business model is going to be. And so this is, you know, who knows? Maybe
no, but
change
this
it.
Is also like, obviously a response. No, this is, I mean, it's the business model, but it's also a response to, and I think some of the serious questions that at least I have, all kidding aside, about how they modulate coming out of, you know, basically juicing the algorithm in a way that has benefited fascism and the alt-right.
Right.
And so now they're putting everything that's independent in the same bucket, which has always been my concern and I think is already a big problem, particularly if you look at Facebook. And this is why I will say, short of, I think, nationalization, monopoly busting, all these really important policy maneuvers, I think the more granular thing that we could ask, and in some respects, I think an analogy I like a lot more about what role people like us have on YouTube is that we're essentially kind of like Uber drivers in a way that's sort of analogous in terms of, if you're a content creator on the platform, particularly if your livelihood depends on it, you're sort of you're a contractor on a platform.
Right.
I think that's actually a very useful analogy. Obviously, it's not the same as driving Uber. Of course, it's nothing like that in terms of difficulty or anything like that. But it's a worthwhile analogy.
The dynamic between you
and the company, and the instability of it relative to the platform, and then the notion that there's this kind of fake independence, even though the reality is the entire model depends on something that is totally out of your control. And I would say that, you know, I'll just go back to my pitch for, you got to hire human beings to start making some of these decisions journalistically. There needs to be a process that's actually properly analyzed that isn't just algorithm driven.
Well, there's also, I mean, it seems to me that what YouTube could do in this specific instance is also allow people to sort of check off a couple of boxes, right? Like,
surprised they don't do that already, frankly.
It's sort of a surprise.
Fit with their
like,
whole
if you say,
model.
Like, what kind of things do I want to look at? I want to look at a mixture of independent and corporate media, corporate-owned media. I like stuff from the left from the right. I can even get even more granular in that in terms of, I mean, I would like cats over dogs, you know.
No, I mean, that's that they should obviously do. It's funny. I mean, that's actually, you know, I've created an algorithm for myself that sort of looks like that, of like, I do sometimes like to watch ABC, MSNBC clips to see, like, you know, not to be totally disconnected from dominant news narrative, obviously. And then, of course, I like to watch a lot of, like, Al Jazeera and German television for the global stuff. And then I watch a selection.
But you work in this business, so you know those different options.
Absolutely. Right. But that would, and I actually think a lot of people would be, that would be a place that they would naturally go to.
I don't know why you
YouTube.
Don't do that on Twitter, too, for that matter.
Yeah.
But
it's a great idea.
Right. Thank you. You're welcome, Google and Twitter. All you guys. You're welcome. Don't forget, you can support this show by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Oh, check out our Instagram feed. We're gonna play a video of Bernie's up there that is going. He basically,
he's feeling himself.
It was pretty funny.
I think there was
somebody
no coincidence.
Dancing around. Yes, but
there's no coincidence yesterday that Cardi B had a beautiful tweet for him. And he had two moments that I think they're both on the list at this Washington Post thing.
Yeah. So you check it out. You can find it on our Instagram, The Majority Report on Instagram. You can become a member of this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com, just pennies a day. And you support this program. And we give you extra content every day. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out the AM Quickie, folks. It's in your feed. Listen to it. Less than 5 minutes. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. First thing in the morning, we're putting it up there. We're getting it out earlier and earlier every day. Soon, we will migrate it off of the feed. Some days, it's me holding down the fort. Some days, there we go. Just crossed the 600,000 threshold.
Thanks, everybody.
Some days it's me. Sometimes it's Lucy Steiner. And check it out, AM Quickie. And if you have any comments on that, send us let us know at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Last night was Tuesday night. Michael, what happened in this office? Why was it such a mess?
It was demonstrably not a mess. We had we didn't even have any beer last night.
I noticed that, actually.
So last night, we at 6 o'clock, we did a really good stream with David Dole of Rational National. And look, if you want to know what's happening in Canadian politics, that was a great primer on it, including, I think there's a lot of interesting lessons to draw globally about green parties. Green parties are very questionable in terms of where they're fitting. And in other countries, it's quite different than the U.S. Green Party. It's more like sort of centrist, bougie green capitalism. Then in the main show that we I did a commentary and analysis of the Mike Pompeo Human Rights Commission and why, in addition to resisting the incredibly dangerous implications of it, we need to have a new conversation on enlarging what human rights are, based on Samuel Moyn's work at Harvard on rights are not enough. Daniel Bessner, Post-Empire Foreign Policy. Then a whole bunch of other stuff. Of course, we talked a ton and played a lot of Marianne Williamson, Dave Rubin clips, as well as the debut of a new character, Civil War Sam Harris. Patreon.com/TMBS this Sunday, illicit history of the movement that's taking place right now in the Sudan with a Sudanese journalist and activist.
Matt, what's up on, what do you call it?
I call it The Literary Hangover. It's my podcast about fiction and history. Yeah, check out, actually the most recent one isn't about history though. It's about Rutger Bregman's Utopia for Realists book and the sort of split and I think debate between Keynesian reformists and Marxist revolutionaries on the left. So check that out.
And as always, check out The Antifada on Patreon.com. Jamie's out under the weather, but the Antifada is alive and well. Quick break, fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.